Today's program was brought to you by El Cortez. Stop in for tacos and tiki drinks at 17 Ingraham Street in Bushwick, or visit them online at elcortezbushwick.com.
Coming this May from Heritage Radio Network, the surprising stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in one special Brooklyn community that's changing faster by the day.
I am 28 years old. I live in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
When I moved to Brooklyn, I chose Bushwick randomly.
We recently opened up in Bushwick.
All over Bushwick.
Bushwick.
Brooklyn, Bushwick.
This is Bushwick Podcast, a series that takes you behind the scenes about people in kitchens, shops, and countless other community spaces create New York City's most dynamic neighborhood. Each week, we step into the journeys that define Bushwick and break down the forces competing to shape its future. These are local stories like you've never heard before. Join us this May, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. It is Heritage Radio Network's 10th anniversary this year, and in celebration of that, I encourage all of you, my listeners, to become members and support us here at HRN. We are a member-supported radio network, really a podcast network, but we call ourselves Radio Network because radio has a nice ring to it. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all the previous episodes of Feast Your Ears can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org, and please leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. Today's theme: think about cooking. Do you think about cooking? I think about cooking a lot. The other day I was visiting family, and as we cleared the breakfast dishes, I asked to nobody in particular, what should we make for dinner? Somebody said, we just finished breakfast, and you want to start making dinner? I said, yes, I eat every day, and I think about what we're going to eat pretty much all the time. It struck me that perhaps not everyone thinks this way. Certainly many of us have the luxury to not worry about where our food comes from or what we're going to eat. I think there's a lot of value, though, in thinking about our food. The further out you think about it, often the more delicious a thing you can make. You can ferment something that you know you'll get to eat in a few days or a few weeks. You can cure a ham or a salami that might not be ready for months or even a year. You can plant seeds that might take months to grow. I think you see where I'm going with this. The more we think about our food, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Deciding when you're driving by a restaurant that you want to eat isn't a bad thing, but it means that things like nutrition and sourcing might not necessarily be on your mind. Again, I'll say that this is a privileged position, and I try to never forget that. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't engage in these thoughts and processes if we can. My family cooks most of our meals at home. And while this sometimes means staring into the cupboard and feeling like I'm on Chopped, with a can of hearts of palm, some cornmeal, tinned fish, and some wilted greens, well, so be it. What it also means is that we belong to a CSA, and starting in a few weeks, we'll get a variety of vegetables every week to use, and that takes some thought. A bonus is that they're grown by people whose lives have been intertwined with ours for more than a decade as they grow food that we eat and we've supported them and their farm and our families have both grown. I love that when I pull a side of salmon out of the freezer from Iliamna Fish Company, I think of Christopher and his wife Emily and their sons, who will decamp from Brooklyn in a month or so for the shores of Bristol Bay, Alaska to catch salmon for this year's share. Christopher Nicholson has been on this show and many others here on Heritage Radio Network. Just this morning, I pulled out some pork from the freezer from Heritage Foods. I stopped to think about Patrick Martins, the founder of this network, who also runs Heritage Foods USA, and the producers that he works with. So think about your food, where it's from, and how you're going to prepare it. My guest today has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about these topics. Michael Ruhlman's been writing about food for the last two decades, and among his many award-winning titles are some of my favorites. He spent years translating the ideas, techniques, and recipes of professional chefs to the home kitchen. If there's something you want to know how to make, it's probably in one of his books. So you should just go out and get them all. You won't be sorry. Thanks, Michael, for coming to the studio here in Bushwick or East Williamsburg, depending on how you want to call the neighborhood on this rainy Monday.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for that very kind introduction.
So you're best known around here at Heritage Radio Network and to many people for your cookbooks and your books about chefs and about how people become chefs at the CIA, and then Grocery, which came out in 2017 about the grocery industry. But you've written a whole host of other books as well. Can you talk a little bit about kind of those other writings?
The other writings I've done, I never set out to write about food. I started as a journalist. And my first book was about boys' education.
Yeah.
And I went to an all-boy high school, and I went back to that high school to write about the efficacy or the harm of all-male education at a time when anything all-male was considered toxic.
Sure.
And then it sort of died down a little bit after the 90s, and now it's all back again.
I mean, my daughter was the first female Cub Scout in Cub Scout Pack 996 here in Brooklyn.
God bless her.
So, I mean, that topic has come up very recently for us.
Then I went to the CIA, to the Culinary Institute of America, to see what the most prominent cooking school needed to know in order to be a chef.
Right.
And I realized very quickly you couldn't be write about this unless you actually became one, because so many of the changes were interior. Hmm. You had to change how you thought. And so I became a cook in order to write that book. And once I was a cook, and this was 1996, 97, the whole country was starting to really become interested in chefs. The Food Network had taken off. The French Laundry had opened. The whole food world was focused on chefs. So I, as a journalist, had something that few other journalists had, which was a culinary education.
Right.
And so I took that and through various sources of both determination and luck, parlayed that into a lot of cookbooks, but almost by accident. But in the meantime, I wrote about wooden boat building, a book called Wooden Boats. The book I'm most proud of writing was about pediatric heart surgery. What I found was that I like working with people who work with their hands with natural products. Boat builders worked with wood. Surgeons work with flesh.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the pressure in the kitchen. Kitchen is a very stressful environment, and it changes who you are because of that stress. I wanted to find out how what happened to surgeons whose skill, you know, as Tom Skeller said to me once, I said, "Are you nervous before service?" He says, "No, it's not like I'm going to kill anybody."
Right.
Well, these guys, if they have a bad day, it's because somebody dies.
Yeah.
I wanted to see how that changed you. So that's how I've written about. I write about people, and I write about what I'm curious about. And, of course, I'm curious about food. And as I've written it over the years, you know, I used to sort of push back the moniker food writer because I thought that was less important. But, my God, our food is making us sick. If we don't have food, we die. It's the most important thing there is. Besides, it's more important than love. It's more important than shelter. You know, thousands, millions get by without shelter, without love. You can't get by without food. You can't get by without story either. And so I combine those two in my work.
I mean, and the work that you've done in food, I think, is valuable not only because of that, but because you have identified, I mean, in the past, you opened up a book, you know, looking at like the 20th century and looking at how cookbooks existed, right? You start in the early 20th century, they were either for people who were homemakers or they were produced by product companies that wanted to sell you their product, right? Mm-hmm. Wanted to sell you their baking powder or whatever it was. But the way that you've approached it in many of your books has way more to do with technique and how people are thinking about using the ingredients that they have. I mean, I'm thinking about a book like Ratio, thinking about a book like 20.
Rollman's 20, yeah. It's all about technique. That's what I learned at cooking school. I started writing about chefs back in Cleveland, where my hometown, for a local magazine because I loved cooking. And I read recipes and I used recipes, but I knew that chefs didn't. And therefore, they knew something that I didn't. I want to know what that was. It's technique. It's the ratio. If you know one technique, you know 100 recipes, 1,000 recipes. So that's why I wrote Rollman's 20. I was sitting with Bill LeBlanc, a former editor of Chronicle Books, and we were at a food writers convention, not just food writers thing at the Greenbrier. And we were having a mint julep after the day's sessions, and Bill said, you know, I'm not really, I've sort of plateaued as a cook. I'm just not getting better. And I said, Bill, there's only like 20 things you need to know in order to cook anything. And he looked at me with his eyes got wide and serious, like I'd said something really evil. And he pointed his finger at me and said, that's a book. And that's how Rollman's 20 started. He wrote it down right there, the 20 things you need to know in order to cook anything, and handed me the paper.
So, I mean, that's a great lead into one of the questions I was going to ask, which is how do you come up with the ideas for your books? I mean, from something like wooden boat building to you have a new book coming out later this year called From Scratch.
Right. From Scratch started because I wanted to write a cookbook. I wanted to write one more cookbook, and I didn't quite know where I was going. I started out to write about fire and water, the high heat cooking and low heat cooking. But the more I thought about it. Well, here's what happened. In 2009, I wrote a post about how to cure pork belly for pancetta. And a chef or a home cook or somebody wrote in and says, well, I grow my own lettuce and tomatoes. I make my own bread. I might as well make this pancetta and make my own BLT. And then someone else chimed in comments saying, I can't get a BLT from scratch out of my head. And so I said, let's make this a challenge, the BLT challenge. Yeah. You have to make your own bread, grow your own lettuce, grow your own tomatoes, cure your own bacon, and make your own mayonnaise. And this one sandwich, I realized, could teach you so much about cooking, how to bake bread, how to make an emulsified sauce, how to cure any meat, how to make a corned beef.
Yeah.
And I looked at 10 meals. Like, what are the 10 meals that can teach us more and more about cooking? And that's how From Scratch started. It's 10 meals, like roast chicken, steak frites, lasagna, cassoulet, that teach us about cooking. Because I want to teach people about cooking, because we're taught that cooking is hard. Cooking is not hard. Thomas Keller said to me just the other day, if what you're doing is hard, you're probably doing it wrong. And it's so true, but we're taught by food manufacturers, by cooking, cookware producers, that cooking is hard and they're going to make it so easy for you.
Well, and I think there's a certain thing that sometimes happens in restaurants. I mean, not to belittle the work of some of the great chefs. I mean, I love, I've met Daniel Hume and I've eaten his food. The 11 Madison Park Cookbook is not a functional book for a home cook.
That's
to
correct.
Use.
I don't know. It's a functional book for chefs to use.
Certain that may also be true.
Nothing against Daniel. He's amazing. That's an amazing restaurant.
And it's a great book too.
Absolutely.
But it's not necessarily a useful book for someone at home who wants to cook for
exactly.
themselves.
No, not at all. And I'm struggling. I'm going back to the French Laundry. That's why I was talking with Thomas. Yeah. We're doing another cookbook with French Laundry and Perse and his chefs there. And I've been struggling with the publisher and the chefs. I said, we've got to make this food accessible. It's just, food has become so complex at these 4-star restaurants that you can't get anywhere near it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to make these things accessible again. It's harder and harder because our cooking has become so complex.
Right.
So anyway, I appreciate that. I'm trying to find both information that's useful to chefs, but also information that home cooks can take advantage of as well.
Right. Is there a specific technique in your years and years of writing about technique that translates from something that a chef might learn in culinary school or might learn working in a restaurant kitchen that is like the number one technique that you would say people should be using at home? And then the other side of that, are there any techniques at use in restaurant kitchens that you feel like don't translate at all?
Well, of course, the first technique is think. Yeah. You were talking about it earlier, thinking about food. First of all, I think about what I'm having 3 days from now. I know what I'm having. It helps you plan. It's not just because I'm obsessed with it, because I am, and I write about it. But it helps you plan. You got to plan. And when you plan, cooking is so much easier. I lost my train of thought.
Thinking would be the number one thing is
seasoning.
Yeah.
Paying attention to salt.
Sure.
Always use the same salt, whether it's Diamond Crystal kosher salt or Morton's kosher salt. Just use the same one. Morton's is twice as strong because it's heavier, it's denser. So just always use the same kind and pay attention to it. Salt your food early. If you're cooking onions, begin salting the onions there, even if the stew is hours away.
Yeah.
Seasoning. How to use an egg is extraordinary. It's so extraordinary. I wrote a whole book about all the things you can do in egg. So just about everything chefs do in the kitchen has some translatable use to the home cook. What's changed in the professional kitchen is the equipment. They have something called a combi oven now.
Right.
The Rationale is what I'm used to. It cooks at precise temperatures. We're even past sous vide now.
Sure.
The combi cooks at precise temperatures with steam, with dry heat. It does just about everything. They're too expensive. Also, most people don't have a proper vacuum sealer. You have a food saver, that kind of thing, but you can't seal liquids. Those two items are really the two main things that don't apply to home kitchens. But other than that, everything does.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we can get by pretty well, I think, without those.
We've been doing it for centuries. Yeah, I think we can.
So you grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I visited Cleveland a couple of times, and one of the things I was really struck by is the West Side Market.
Oh,
Cleveland.
Yeah. It is a marvel. I've been going there since I was a kid. It's an absolute marvel. It was built in 1910, I believe, as a purpose-built market for the community. It's a beautiful old structure. It's filled with case after case of salami and fresh fruits. If I needed a pig's head, that's where I go. If I need call fat, I could get it there. If I need rabbit, that's where I go.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary, bustling place. A friend walked in and said, my gosh, almost like Vietnam here. So the market of Vietnam.
Interesting.
It's a lot like the market in Detroit.
Yep.
Detroit is a great market. Yep. There are other great markets throughout
the Detroit one's called East Side Market.
East Side Market, right? Thank you.
Yeah. And in Cleveland, it's West Side.
That's interesting. Yeah. I never thought of that. Anyway, so I was lucky to have that.
Yeah, I mean, I find it too bad in New York that some of those things have been lost. I mean, I feel like Arthur Avenue in the Bronx is sort of a similar area to that. Essex Street is now moved, right? Essex is about to move across to the south side of Delancey Street
there,
and into a giant brand new building.
I just walked
curious
past
to see
that.
How that sort of translates.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, hard to know.
But it's harder here in New York City because somebody is selling. And you can get anything you want from somebody somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's hard to have it all collected in one spot in New York City.
Yeah, of course. So you grew up in Cleveland, lived there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Now you split your time between Manhattan and Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes, I've remarried a wonderful woman named Ann Hood. She's a writer. Her book just came out called Kitchen Yarns. And this is interesting because she was with her agent and editor, and she just got a best food writing essay put in the anthology that year, and said, we should do a book of your food essays. And she said, I don't write about food. And she said, well, you just got an award, you know, just got this nice accolade. And she started thinking about it, and she said, I didn't know it, but I use food to get into so many other topics, because food leads us into other areas of life. Food's a great connector of all people. So I got remarried, moved to the West Village. She lives in both Providence, and she teaches at NYU in the New School. So we split our time between Providence and New York City, and it's heavenly.
Yeah, I mean, if you could get there without having to drive through Connecticut on 95, it would be a dream,
Connecticut.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
My wife's family is all up there, and so I drove back from Rhode Island yesterday.
I drove in Saturday.
Where do you shop in Providence?
There's a place called the East Side Market, which was a great place, and then Stop and Shop bought it, and they have pretty much ruined it. Thank you, Stop and Shop.
Yeah.
There are no great grocery stores there. I wish there was a Heinen's like I had in Cleveland, or a Wegmans, or something like that. And if I need a specialty item, I have to go to a chef friend and say, can you get me some pork belly or get me some duck legs or something like that. So it's hard.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here on Heritage Radio Network. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about Heinen's and about your book, Grocery.
Today's program was brought to you by El Cortez, a colorful bi-level restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. El Cortez sports a bar on each floor, a patio for drinking zombies in the moonlight, and the capacity for just under a couple hundred revelers. New York Magazine's Chris Crowley profiled El Cortez, saying its owners aren't trying to mine Mexican restaurants of any era, but just mesh together a bunch of things that they like. The menu focuses on what they call all three Mexicans: hot plate, gringo, and Mexican. There's no fried chicken queso or chili con carne, but mission-style burritos, loaded all-American tacos, and a chimichanga. There's also a cheeseburger, because who cares? Cocktails lean heavily in the direction of tiki and the kind of lowbrow drinks that caused the mixology revolution. Classic drinks your grandparents definitely drank, like the pina colada and rum punch, made with quality ingredients and a whole bunch of trial and error. Visit El Cortez at 17 Ingraham Street in Bushwick, or online at elcortezbushwick.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is author Michael Ruhlman, who you may know from his vast array of cookbooks and books about food, but he also writes a lot of other things, a lot of journalistic things, including a memoir about fixing up an old house, one of your books. So before the break, we were touching on your book, Grocery, which really was in that journalistic style and was an investigation of the grocery business in America. One of the things I found really interesting about it, you know, there's been lots of articles and lots of things, and I coming out of someone who ran a small grocery.
Did you really?
Yeah, yeah, the Brooklyn Kitchen, you know, we had our whole grocery thing.
You had a grocery.
Yeah, we had a whole.
You know how.
I mean, I know. It's gone now. We've closed it. But it's too hard. It's too hard, exactly. And, you know, there's been a lot of things written about the sort of the death of small grocery, but you focused on a company, you know, Heinen's, which has, I think, 6 locations in Queens.
No, it has about 20 locations.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So it's a medium-sized
chain. Yeah, medium-sized grocery, not small.
It's pretty, in terms of the industry, it's small.
Sure.
You know,
but compared to what we had, it's large, right?
That's large. Yeah, you are very small, and there are single family grocers out there, and God bless them for doing that work. But and Heinen's with 20, and now like 4 in Chicago.
Yeah,
you know they will do more than $500 million in sales, and they're still considered a small family business.
Sure,
I mean the profit margin is so tiny.
Yeah, I mean it's wild. I mean so you basically in similar fashion to how you went into the CIA and became a chef, became a cook, you went and worked.
I worked.
I shadowed Heinen's for a number of years.
I did. I was, in fact, I would actually. I'd gotten divorced, and people would see me bagging groceries wearing a Heinen's shirt, and they would just say, "Oh boy, he's fallen on hard times." But yeah, I bagged groceries. I stocked shelves and hung out with the grocery managers, with the produce managers, with the butchers and fishmongers. I went to farms where they were getting their food. I was like, I went to grocery stores every day, but I didn't know where any of the food was coming from.
Yeah.
How could I get Peapods in Cleveland any day of the year, as much as I wanted, it seemed like.
Yeah.
Any day of the year. And not only just in Cleveland, but in any of the grocery stores in Cleveland and in any grocery in America.
Yeah.
Where were all these Peapods coming from?
Yeah.
And so that's what I really wanted to find out. And it gives you a sense of how vast this country is and how much we rely on the growers of food to get us the food. We take it for granted, and we can't, or it's going to seriously screw us up. It's already started making us sick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so. It's a very, and it becomes a very difficult thing because, I mean, as I said in the opener, like, we are privileged to sit here and talk about these topics.
Yes.
And unfortunately, the people who are really getting sick from a lot of this food are people who don't have that luxury.
That's absolutely right. There are studies show that people are more likely to die younger if they don't live near a grocery store.
Yeah.
If they're forced to, by just sheer physicality and location, to eat processed food, they're going to develop health, food-related illnesses, and they're going to die earlier.
Right.
That's how important a grocery store is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the other thing that's happening, so I think last night or this morning, you know, I mean, I get a zillion, like, you know, spam emails a day. And I got one, I think, from Postmates and one from DoorDash saying, you know, you haven't ordered food in a while. Don't you want to order some food delivered? And I think, you know, and I immediately deleted it, but I thought to myself, you know, that's something I never do. I mean, takeout is something we do very, very rarely in our family because we just are obsessed with food and we cook nearly all the time. And I love going to grocery stores and I love shopping and finding what we're going to eat. But I think about the fact that for so many people, they don't even know how to cook. And they don't even think that their first thought is, I'm going to order this, or I'm going to get it on Seamless, or I'm going to, you know, reach for my, you know, liquid-based food replacement therapy.
Right. It's because they think cooking's hard.
Yeah.
They don't plan, and they think cooking hard. But some people are really, really busy.
Of course.
And they can. They've got kids.
Absolutely.
And some people just don't like to cook, and that's fine, too.
Right.
But you have to do it. So you have to find some way to do it. Within your means, within your family structure, somebody in your tribe has to gather the food. Somebody has to prepare it.
Yeah.
Even if it's ordering the pizza. I mean,
it
just depends on how you want to handle it.
Yeah.
And I believe and know, and as you know, that the cooking of food in a home is a pleasure and makes that home better. It actually relieves stress to smell food. Cooking, it relieves our stress. And if we're cooking our own food, that means it's going to be better for us. We're going to be more healthy. It's going to be nutritious food. There are many benefits to cooking your own food. If people would recognize that more, I try to get people to recognize that. People say, you know, nobody says, I'd love to shower, but I'm just too busy. No one says that. It's all a matter of how we prioritize
Absolutely.
What we do.
Yeah. And you know, and you have a thing now where I think because of the way it has been industrialized and become something that, you know, hedge funds can invest in, the fitness you know, industry has become enormous. When, you know, not that there's anything wrong with fitness. I mean, I work out, but what you eat has more impact on your health than how many calories you burn at the gym.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Calories in, calories out, as far as weight loss goes, works for me, but, those calories come in different forms, as you know, and some are good for you and some are bad. And we don't really even understand why necessarily. I mean, it's very important. Eating eating the same amount of sugar that's in a grape is different from eating that grape because there's a fiber matrix that holds all that those carbohydrates. So I think if we eat whole foods, we don't need to worry about. We won't need to worry. You'll find your natural weight anyway.
Yeah.
And so some of us are chunky.
Yeah.
And some of us are slim. And the people who are, you know, unhealthily overweight are probably eating poorly.
Yeah. And it's a vicious cycle. I mean, unfortunately,
it is. It's hard, and I wish there was an answer for it, but there isn't. I think that we need to eat what's appropriate for our bodies. We need to listen to our bodies and how the food affects us after we've eaten it, or an hour after we've eaten. Do we feel good?
Yep.
I think that's a good indication. If we feel too stuffed, we've eaten too much. I love Pringles. I love Pringles potato chips. They're not even potato chips. They're crisps or something like that. But if I eat a can of them, I feel awful afterwards. That's my body telling me these are not good for you. But if I eat a steak and a buttery baked potato, I feel great.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very interesting way to approach it, to think about how the food is going to make you feel after. And that is part of the thinking about it. Right.
Absolutely.
Part of the thinking about how you're going to feel, how it's going to affect your body after the fact, you know, plays into it. I mean, I was working out the other day and someone said, oh, you know, if you're really stressing your muscles, you need to eat a lot of protein. And I hadn't thought about it in that way before. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, now I was thinking, well, okay, I guess I need to eat some protein to help the muscle fibers rebuild and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But hadn't ever really considered what I was eating based on what I had been doing.
But I'll bet your body would tell you if you're seriously stressing your muscles and you do need that protein, you're going to be hankering for a steak or a burger or a big pot of beans or something with a lot of protein in it.
Yeah.
Because your body's, it knows. It's keeping track of what made me feel good when I need this.
Yeah.
Two things. Yeah, think about food and think about how you feel afterwards. And don't think about healthy food. Don't think of food as healthy. Food isn't healthy.
Right.
We're healthy.
Right.
Food is nutritious. If you think about, is this nutritious? That's very easy. You know, steak and potatoes, there's lots of nutrients in there. Is there nutrients in Pringles? No.
Right. But, you know, we also, you know, we are human. And so if you want to have some Pringles sometime, you should be allowed to.
Absolutely.
Jesuit self-flagellation thing that people go through where they're like, oh, you know, I can have this piece of pizza because I spent an hour on the treadmill.
I know. We're so fucked up about food. We treat food like medicine here in America, and we should treat food as a joy and a pleasure and a luxury, and we should care for it and be careful about it and consume it thoughtfully.
So you write a lot about your father in Grocery, and you responded to my question of who would you like to have dinner with. You'd like to have dinner with your father who passed away.
I'm going to start crying right now if you talk about that. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was clearly a big influence on you and on your, you know, you say that his like Saturday pastime was going to the grocery store.
It's one of his favorite hobbies. In fact, he often said, when I retire, I think I'm going to go bag groceries. I just love to see what people are buying. I love to see what's out there. That's why I wrote Grocery. Yeah. I think I was missing him. I started writing it the year after he died in 2008 and then eventually came back to it to finish the book. But he loved to eat. He was exactly like you when you were talking about what are we going to eat for dinner. I mean, while we were in the middle of dinner, he would be saying, what do you want to have for dinner tomorrow night?
Right.
And so that's where I got that from.
And what sort of things, like how did food work in your family when you were growing up? Was your dad the cook? Did your mom cook? Did, you know, you obviously started cooking at a relatively young age as well.
I did, because both my parents worked. And so we always ate dinner really late, 8 o'clock. My friends couldn't believe it.
Yeah, me too. When I was growing up, same.
My dad loved to grill, so we would grill. My mom, they shared in the cooking equally. both liked to cook, and we hung out in the kitchen. That's where we had conversations. So it was a place of good smells and warmth and conversation. And it was just me, my dad, and my mom. I was an only child. And that's why I learned to cook, because I was hungry after school, and the Pop-Tarts weren't cutting it after so long. Because they wouldn't be home till 6, and I had 3 hours. And yeah. So the first thing I learned in fourth grade is how to make a potato onion frittata. So I made that, and my friends were mystified. My friends were mystified that I could make my own popcorn. It's, you know, it's silly how little we know about food, but it's so easy. There's even a recipe for how to make popcorn in the new book, from scratch.
Oh, cool.
Because it's from scratch, and people... Yeah. My son didn't know that there was such a thing as... He once asked me for pot popcorn, and I thought, there's a six-year-old asking for pot popcorn? What is that? So, you know... In a pot on the stove, as opposed to in the microwave.
Right.
And some people, I wrote about this. Some parents said, my kids didn't know you could do that.
Right.
They thought it all came in a cellophane wrap
bag. Yeah. So what else do you have in the works? I mean, so From Scratch is now done. I mean, it's packaged, it's being printed and all that stuff.
It is. It's in its final stages before going to the printer out in October. Of this year, and Pâté Confit Rillette has just come out with my friend Brian Polson.
How did you and Brian first start working together?
Well,
that's now your third book with him, right?
It's our third book together. I was on assignment for the New York Times Magazine to write about the Certified Master Chef exam at the Culinary Institute of America, which I just finished my book about. He was one of the chefs that were taking this test, this crazy 10-day cooking test, to certify you as a master chef. And he was the most interesting, articulate guy, and I just really liked him. And I knew that he taught, from that work, I knew that he taught charcuterie at Schoolcraft College in Livonia, Michigan, outside Detroit. And I had become obsessed with duck confit. And I looked into it, I read about it, I made it, you know, the idea of taking this rich duck leg and poaching it in fat, curing it, salting it first, seasoning it, poaching it in fat, letting it ripen in that fat for as long as you could stand to wait, and then crisping it up in the oven, and it gave you the most delicious duck anything on the planet, and as far as I was concerned. And when I read more about it, I realized, wow, we didn't come up with this ingenious way of cooking duck because it pleased us.
Right.
We did this to stay alive.
Yeah. And so it would last.
So it would last, so it would preserve, so we could live through the winter.
Yeah.
And when I realized that, I thought, God, I want to look more into this this craft of preserving food, of preserving meat especially. And so I called up Brian and said, do you want to write a book? And he said, sure.
So we wrote charcuterie.
That's how charcuterie came to be. That was really successful. He wanted to write more about salumi, so we did a book on salumi, dry curing. It's a very hard subject. It's hard to cure a ham. It's hard to cure a salami.
Yeah.
But there are some fanatics out there who want to do it, and certainly a lot of chefs have gotten into it.
Well, and I think you were, again, like right place and time kind of thing. I mean, when we first opened the Brooklyn Kitchen in 2006, it was right when, you know, Jim Leahy's No Need Bread recipe came out. And I was messing around at the time with Tom Milan, who later became a business partner in the Meat Hook with me, of, you know, we were making salami in my basement, you know, hanging it in an old refrigerator that I had with a fan inside, you know.
I know.
And so that all that stuff was all happening all at that moment.
Yeah. So I think I've had my finger on the pulse of stuff, as you have. And when you're sort of obsessed with food, you do that. And I just happened to write about it.
Yeah.
And now we've just come out with one sort of exploring further how to perfect pâtés and how to, you know, the various ways you can use a confit and how to make rillettes, just because we love the subject and we felt that there was more finesse that we could describe in this. It's got nice pictures in this book, too.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I mean, I feel like that book really is in a place where, you know, it is both useful to chefs in restaurants who want to be serving that kind of thing, or maybe are working on a whole animal program or want to, you know, limit their waste and be using more of the things that usually get trimmed off, as well as people who are, you know, weekend warriors, for lack of a better way to put it, that's what their hobby is, right?
Sure.
A hobbyist who is like, I'm going to perfect this pâté en croûte. Now, as someone who has a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, I'm not going to be making pâté en croûte at least for 13 or 14 years, but maybe. You
could make it easy chicken mousseline with mushrooms and, you know.
And I can make duck confit. I mean, that's, you know.
That's a no-brainer. Yeah. That's convenience food.
Exactly. Just pull it out of the fridge, you know, on Monday night when I get home.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Michael, we're just about out of time.
But I was just getting started.
Well, maybe we can go have a pizza if you want. But thank you so much for taking time to come down and hang out in the studio and chat with me today.
Always a pleasure to talk about food.
You can follow Michael on social media at Ruhlman. That's R-U-H-L-M-A-N. And you can have a look at his website, Ruhlman.com. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to Matt Patterson, our engineer here at Heritage Radio Network. You can find this as well as about 35 other shows every week at heritageradionetwork.org on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. And definitely keep an eye out for From Scratch coming out in October from my guest today, Michael Ruhlman. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family and become a member. Thanks for listening.